Now, the following show is dedicated to Barbara and Mia, two good friends of mine. So this show is dedicated to you two.
The views expressed on the following show may not be those of the hosts, guests, or WSPN Skidmore Radio. Talk Saratoga is produced by Saratoga Broadcasting Incorporated and may not be reproduced in part or in whole unless expressed written approval is given. Now, here are the hosts of Talk Saratoga, Rick Thompson and a Saratoga All-Star.
Okay, good morning and welcome to Talk Saratoga. I'm your host, Rick Thompson. You're listening to WSPN 91.1 FM on the Skidmore Radio Show. This morning we have a great guest with us. His name is Ben Kemp, and he's the operations manager for the U.S. Grant College State Historical Site. And the U.S. Grant stands for Ulysses S. Grant, our former president. So Ben was born and raised in the Saratoga region. He's a living historian, a speaker, and a researcher who has been featured by C-SPAN, PBS, and the National Park Service, and the 2020 History Channel documentary, Grant. He is the operations manager at the U.S. Grant College State Historic Site, where he's been a staff member since 2014, when he was only 7 years old. And he has published numerous online articles on Grant and is a contributing author to Grant at 200, Reconsidering the Life and Legacy of Ulysses S. Grant. And Ben enjoys outdoor pursuits such as hiking, having climbed all the 46 highest peaks in the Adirondacks. He also has a passion for antique show, flea markets, demolition derby, bluegrass music, and roller coasters. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
That's quite an impressive list there, I tell you. And I threw that 7 years old in because you look like you're in your 20s. So.
Oh, well, that's quite the compliment. You know how to get guests to come back at some
point. Well, you do. And I'm glad to have you with us this morning. Some other interviews you've done have mainly been focused on Grant's life and the historic site's history. Why don't you give us a little bit about Grant's life? And we've got some items to bring up a little bit. I was telling you that 10 items. I think that's on the website, which is a great website, by the way. And you can get on the website by going to
grantcottage.org. Grantcottage.org.
Okay. And if you need to contact them, it's info@grantcottage.org. Why don't you tell us a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. I think most people have at least a recognition of Grant. Ulysses S. Grant, the Civil War general and two-term United States president. And I think most people have at least, you know, that basic knowledge of him. But outside of that, because of, you know, the number of figures and the amount of history that we have to fit into our education system, people have, you know, a fairly limited knowledge outside of that, you know, of who he is. And that's where I think historic sites like ours, you know, really are so important to be able to tell more about these individuals, to be able to understand them better. And, you know, that's certainly true for what we do at Grant Cottage and many other historic sites around the nation, around the world. And so in terms of Ulysses S. Grant, you know, he was born in 1822 in southern Ohio. Pretty simple childhood. He wasn't necessarily impoverished, but he wasn't. His father made a good business in the leather industry. He went to West Point as a 17-year-old, and then he entered the military right before the Mexican-American War. Okay. And so he served in that, met his wife just before he went off to war, but didn't marry her until after the war in the late 1840s. He then continued in different military posts after the Mexican War, and then he went off to the West Coast. He was separated from his family for a couple of years, and that was really intolerable to him to not be with his family, and so he did resign from the Army about 10 years before the Civil War. And so he made a go of civilian life for a little while, and then he lived on his wife's family's estate in St. Louis, Missouri for a little while, moved north to Galena, Illinois, and that's where the Civil War would break out shortly after he arrived in Galena. And then he would serve in the Union Army during the Civil War and rise from the rank of, he started as a colonel and rise all the way to the commander of all the Union forces by the end of the four-year war. After the war, he continued to serve as general, and then eventually he had no interest in it, but he would be basically coerced into becoming president of the United States for two full terms. So he served his nation almost, continuously from 17 years of age until, he left the presidency in 1877 and then went on a two-year world tour, came back, settled in New York City, and then had financial trouble at the end of his life, and wrote his memoirs to make money for his family as he was dying of throat cancer. And that's where he's going to come to Grant Cottage at the very, very end of his life. And he's in his early 60s at that point, but suffering from throat cancer and trying to complete this work of literature to restore his family's finances, to give them a future. And so that's in a nutshell, that's his amazing 63-year life. Yeah.
You know, we talked about how sick he was when he was writing his book, and that he struggled at points but wanted to get that finished. And I mean, you were saying that he knew he wasn't going to make much money on it, but that he was doing it for his family. Did his family stay around after he passed away?
Yeah, it was, and that's one part of the story we focus on a lot that's unknown, and that's the family members and how he regarded his family. He was an absolutely devoted family man. I mean, incredibly. Because in that era, there was, it was expected for individuals of high stature to possibly even spend time away from their families for their professional careers, especially politicians. And he was never happy away from his family. That he always wanted them close. They were a support structure for him, and of course he was their support as well. And so they were a very tight-knit family. And that shows in the fact that when they went to this summer home, Grant Cottage, during his final illness, all four of his adult children went with him, as well as his wife Julia. And so they did have four adult children by that time. All their children survived. You had Fred and Jesse, Ulysses Jr., and Ellen. They called her Nellie. And so three sons and a daughter. And they all had spouses and children as well. So there's quite a descendancy. Nellie did go off to England and marry an Englishman, but she ended up coming back to the U.S. And so they all did live out their lives in the United States eventually. All the sons and the daughter. Fred would be the only one to go into the military. So they lived into the early 20th century and the two sons lived out in California. Fred stayed in this area as a military man, and Nellie lived in Washington. And Julia would survive her husband in all the way until 1902 when she passed.
Oh. You know, for people that want to know where Grant Cottage is, it's in Wilton on Route 9, and so it's very local. I mean, I don't know if people have the idea that it's somewhere far away, but it's right in our backyard. And, I encourage everybody to go up and take a visit. Because there's always something to learn. I mean, I was picking up some things just before the radio show. Throat cancer back then had to be terrible. My father at 52 got throat cancer. And with all the drugs and that today, they gave him 10 years. But he if this was at 52, and he lived to be 86. So, but it's a terrible disease if you can't treat it. So he must have been suffering really bad and writing a book at the same time.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, oral cancer is still difficult to diagnose early on, and you know, it can get to an advanced stage. And so certainly back then, there was actually some treatments that could be done for certain cancers. Most of it was just removal, I think, of the cancer. They didn't have any kind of, you know, radiation treatments at the time. But so Grant was certainly in a very difficult situation. And by the time they, you know, he sought medical help for it, you know, they basically concluded that it was too late for any kind of, and the location that it was in, it just was inoperable. So it was basically trying to keep him as comfortable as possible, and that included whatever medicines they had at the time, which, interestingly enough, a few of our artifacts that are left at the cottage, because Grant's belongings were left there as part of the memorial to him after he died there. One of them is a jar of solution, and the solution has cocaine in it. And so they used that as a topical solution. It was fairly new treatment at the time to try to give him some topical pain relief, but it was specifically because of the book project. Oh. Because normally someone in his condition would be given morphine injections, and they were giving him morphine injections, but if they gave him the morphine during the day,
he couldn't,
you know, keep his mind clear enough to work on the book. And so they during the day, they would switch over to the cocaine topical applications. And amazingly, 140 years later, we still have that jar with the original liquid in it, with the cocaine sitting on the cabinet there in the museum. And so it's just a fascinating reminder of, again, what he was going through at the time, like you said, in the struggle. And again, just that amazing effort that he put forth, that selfless effort to make sure that his book was done, you know, his memoirs that he was writing there at the end, to make sure his family had a future.
You know, I think if you have a focus on getting something done, that gives you a strength to do it. I had knee surgery last year, knee replacement, and I had a focus on someone coming back to college. And in 4 weeks, I was out taking her to breakfast with a cane the first week. But, you know, you have a focus, and that drives you to do things.
You hear that in the private conversations that you know, were recorded at the time about Grant's condition and what was going on. His family, even Samuel Clemens, better known as Mark Twain, his publisher of the book, you know, said that this book is keeping him alive. This book project is keeping him alive. And I think that was, you know, certainly the case. Grant was a very persistent and, you know, person when he had something, you know, that he felt was worth doing, he never turned back. That was his thing. There was no turning back.
Well, that's made him what he was. I mean, it made him a great general and a great president, because he did a lot, which we'll get into. Some of the things that that you're doing at the college before, we're at Skidmore College, so cottage and college has two
should be
the same
a grand
letters.
College,
that's
know?
Right. There should be a Grant College. Maybe they'll add a wing on.
Yeah.
You know,
there you go.
Like they're adding on to the gym. But the Skidmore students really did help back in 2017, didn't they? With interpreting the style back then. I know that's that you had mentioned.
Yeah,
that.
What occurred was, you know, we were really, you know, you have a famous individual and they died in a location. You know, that's a story,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't have too much that's going to engage too many people. It's not going to reach too many people on a personal level. But when you get into the story, as we've been talking about a little bit, the fact that he was so devoted to his family, and talking about your personal experience with cancer in your family, that is the type of stuff, that is the type of interpretation we want to do, that we want to, have something that's relevant to people, mm-hmm. and that they can kind of touch something on their own lives or something that really it engages them. They make a connection with these people of the past that had hopes and dreams. And the Grant family really shows that amazing, family dynamic. And that's what struck me, like I said, when I first went there. He only lived there 6 weeks. He was in very desperate state of health, and they were just trying to get him to a better climate because mm-hmm. he was living in New York City in the 1880s. It's a terrible atmosphere for someone with any kind of, health issues. And so they brought him up to Mount McGregor, just north of Saratoga Springs, for that very reason.
Yeah.
So what happened was the Skidmore students, through the history department, worked on a project to look at the interpretation that we already had, giving our half an hour tours of the historic cottage. And then they said, how can this really achieve this better interpretive goal of really connecting people to the story on a more personal level? And so the story was shifted from the famous, man died here, to a story about family devotion. So it's not just a dry story about, certain, artifacts and dates and times. We have more, a little bit more. We try to put more of that personal storytelling in it that really people do respond really strongly to it. Yeah.
Well, sure. Many historical figures led a very interesting life, but we don't know it. Mm-hmm. And because there hasn't been any research done like this, and if we knew, I think people would become more interested in that figure if they knew a little bit about their life and how they lived and, what made them the person they are. We always pick up historical figures at the point, like Grant, when he was general during the Civil War. And there's a lot more that made the man.
It makes them relatable. It makes them, we tend to put our heroes on pedestals, and certainly they should be recognized for what they did, but it can also be, what they achieve seems unattainable to everyone else, mm-hmm. looking to their future. And that shouldn't be that way.
Right.
You should understand that they had their struggles when they were younger, they had their adversities, and they didn't just, it didn't just miraculously occur. They put hard work in, typically, and there was reasons why they ended up the way they were. And,
sure.
And certainly Grant's story does reveal that, even in his own memoirs. It's largely a military memoir.
Mm-hmm.
But there's biographies about him that go into more detail about his life, and it's incredible what he did in 63 years. I mean, just incredible. The amount of things that he did and saw and, for that time period. So.
Really? Well, people don't realize that many famous people have insecurities.
Hmm.
And they're very insecure. So if they persevere through that, that just goes to their character also. And because there's a lot of self-doubt when you are in a position like Grant was and having to make the decisions that he did and always second guessing yourself, is this the right decision? Mm-hmm. Should I have gone this way? So there's so much to a person's life and that people don't know. And it's a shame. Like you said, you can relate to them better if you know a little bit about their personal life until the time they get very famous. And then you're picking it up from there. But one of the things too, is that we'll get into the strategic plan that you're going to do. You're a seasonal program.
Essentially May through October.
Okay.
We'll be opening April 27th this year, which is Grant's birthday.
Neat.
A little special this year for our opening day.
Neat.
Saturday the 27th. But we'll be open through October. And the varying days of the week, depending on what time of the year. But you can find that information on our website as well.
Sure. And hopefully it won't be snowing on April 27th.
We've gotten a little dusting, a couple years ago in May even. But
really?
It's short-lived.
This is a little bit ridiculous. Yeah.
It is a mountain, after all. 1,000 feet is where the cottage sits on the side of the mountain there.
Yeah, it's up. One of the things I want to talk about now is... you want to dispel certain historical myths about Grant, because a lot of people say things, and then it gets into the history as actually happening. And so, can you talk a little bit about questions people have about Grant and his family? I know we've got a list of 10 things here that are on the site that kind of talk about his term and some of the myths. One of them is he's known as Ulysses S. Grant, and I read where the S doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, everything means something, right? But But I think when you have a famous figure, obviously there's going to be both, and you have to kind of fit them in a small bubble in the pop culture world. You know, Grant is known as the Civil War hero and the president. And, you know, was he a drunkard? Was he, there's a number of, myths that develop around these famous people. Some of them have a little basis in reality, but they usually just get kind of mythologized over the years and exaggerated over the years. What I like to do is give people a better perspective. Again, I like to remain objective, but give people a better perspective. Something like Ulysses S. Grant, how did he end up with that name? He was born and named at birth Hiram Ulysses Grant. It was kind of the in-laws thing. So the in-laws wanted Hiram, and his parents wanted Ulysses, and so it became a compromise. But because he lived obviously with his parents, they just called him by his middle name, Ulysses. And when Grant went to West Point, he had to be appointed by a congressman, and so the congressman who knew Grant's father. Didn't know his official name. I mean, they didn't have as much paperwork that back then. And so he had known that he was called Ulysses around the house, and his mother, Hannah, her maiden name was Simpson, which is Scots Irish. And so so the congressman just assumed that since he was the first born child, male child, that he would have the mother's maiden name a middle name. And so it was kind of just a guess. Ulysses S. Grant, he shows up at West Point, 17 years old. That's what's on the paperwork. They say, he says, this must be me. It makes sense otherwise. He says, but that's not my name. And basically, more or less, they told him, it's going to be your name now. We're not redoing the paperwork.
That's right, yeah.
So
yeah.
Eventually, slowly, he started to adopt that, kind of out of a necessity. And later on, they would he would actually joke about it at times that the S stood for nothing, and he even found it kind of amusing that his wife Julia decided to name their secondborn son Ulysses Grant Jr. Ulysses Simpson Grant Jr. when he said that's not even really
that's
my
not
name.
Even real, is
so
it?
it was kind of a running joke there, but it ended up being a very for him a very patriotic name, because
U.S. Grant,
Grant. And then you had after his first major victory in the Civil War, he asked for unconditional surrender of Fort Donelson, so he became unconditional surrender Grant. So it stood for different things depending on.
Well, it's better than my grandfather when he came over from Italy. This is back in the late 1800s. If they couldn't read your name on the tag, they gave you a last name. So it may not even have been your name, but that's what they rolled down.
Yeah, names certainly were a little more fluid back in the 19th
century. That's right. So, I can see that. But I don't know if it's a myth or a fact that he was unlucky in business.
It's an oversimplification. Generalities are what we suffer from in history, because you have to generalize unless you want to get into all the details and context of everything. And that's the boring stuff. That's the minutiae. People want to just give it to me really straight. Was he this or was he that?
Right.
Well, the answer isn't quite that simple. At times he struggled with different enterprises. When he was a farmer, he struggled with, you could say, he was a failure at a farmer. But as a farmer, at farming, but it's not really accurate, because he was actually, good at growing the crops, but getting investment money to put into the crops and then also selling them during a major financial crisis in the United States. Both of those things affected on both ends his ability to actually be, quote unquote, a successful farmer. So some of it's taking a little credit away from him, the work he put in. and what his abilities were as opposed to outside forces. And that happened quite a bit to him, is outside forces would cause his failure, not necessarily him failing as an individual.
Right.
So not to give him, you know, I mean, certainly he had weaknesses as a human. But I think sometimes it's everybody loves the rags to riches story.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We love to paint that. And to some extent, you know, he really did work hard for what he did. And you know, he put a lot of himself into everything he did. But and we don't want to take that credit away. But certainly there was individuals that helped him along the way.
I think even in businesses today, there's outside forces that, you know, influence the businesses one way or the other, and you can be a failure through no fault of your own. I mean, like COVID affected a lot of businesses, and they lost their business, but it wasn't because of the work they did, you know, as outside forces.
Well, one great example is the very end of his life, because he invested with his son in a Wall Street investment firm, which they named Grant Ward. Now, him and his son, Ulysses Jr., they, you know, everything looked good on the surface. They invested with this partner, Ferdinand Ward, and everything looked good. For a few years, early 1880s, the money was coming in and the family was living comfortably, and Grant thought he was very successful. There was no presidential pension back then, so he was literally making his way after the presidency on a personal basis, business basis. They didn't do the books, though. They were essentially investors, even though they were partners. And so, and secretly, Ward was running a Ponzi scheme. And so they didn't know this. And then people say, well, he must have been so naive or this, that, and the other thing. But when you look at it, there was many other very shrewd businessmen that were also duped by Ward, investors. And it was actually hard to prosecute Ward because a lot of these investors didn't want to be come out and admit that they were swindled.
Right.
And so, you know, that again, that's another situation where Grant, again, you know, certainly was not, you know, the most experienced businessman. And he may have been a little bit easier of a mark. He was a very trusting man. He liked to give people, you know, a lot of chances. He liked to believe the best in people. You know, and people took advantage of that on occasion. You know, his you know, kind of honest character. They took advantage of that.
And again, that happens all the time.
Yeah, and you almost say, is that really a weakness, you know?
But
it is in terms of people that are going to take advantage of you, I guess. He had some friends, you know, influential friends that would try to, you know, protect him from that to some extent, but you know, eventually fell victim there.
A thing about Lincoln, but I think Lincoln was the same way in business. I mean, he was a great man, but he had his struggles early on in life, too, which goes to show that you can become famous even though in your early years you can have problems one way or the other. So the next one was, Grant was the first, he won the first major Union victory of the Civil War. And where was that?
So in early 1862, this is the second year of the war, Grant is in the Western Theater, what they call the Western Theater. The Eastern Theater is the big battles you hear about, Gettysburg and all that, over in the Eastern Theater in Virginia and Pennsylvania and that area. And then in the West, you have areas like, you know, Missouri, Tennessee, and you know, Mississippi, that whole area around the Mississippi River. Now, Grant knew that the Mississippi River and its tributaries, that was essential to winning the war, that had to be captured, the waterways, the railroad systems, because that's what was feeding the Confederate war machine, the enemies at the time, his enemy. And so, you know, he one of his early focuses was on a place called Forts Henry and Donelson. They were close to each other, and protecting some rivers in that area. And so he knew that this would be a key to unlocking, you know, that certain region and occupying it with the Union forces. And so he went after Fort Donelson, and it was a difficult. It was February, and it was a bad weather down there in Tennessee. But he was able, him and his army were able to take both forts, and he, you know, was celebrated. And it's interesting because the story comes out of there, which is that the grateful Northern public, you know, they wanted to reward people back then.
Okay.
You know, so they wanted to reward General Grant, this relatively unknown general at that time. You know, he wasn't really the famous hero. They rewarded him with cases and cases of cigars.
Really?
Right. So because a newspaper reporter saw him with a cigar. He wasn't that heavy of a smoker prior to this. And afterwards, he even says in his memoirs, I started smoking a lot more than I would have just because I had 10,000 cigars sitting at my headquarters. So they ended up, you know, it can be argued that the Northern public actually killed their favorite general, on accident, because he would take on that habit and keep it for the rest of his life. But the myth is that he smoked, 20 cigars a day. Even saying up to 20 a day is ludicrous. Because if you think about it, 20 cigars a day is chain smoking
one
large cigars.
Yeah.
So, I did a whole study on it, and reality was he may have smoked, four or five a day. The reason people thought, which was still a lot, but the reason people thought he smoked more was because he always had one in his mouth. So he chewed on them, and we know that that can contribute to oral cancer too. So certainly it was a major factor in his health and his eventual death. But at the time, they didn't understand the dangers.
It's funny how people rewarded people back then. I read a story about Napoleon, getting off the subject of Grant, but he always awarded his soldiers with medals, and they ran out of medals because that would build up their appreciation for him and give them. So what he ended up doing was having the buttons removed from the dead soldiers, and he would present them as medals just to give them something to achieve. So I can see where, he gets all these awards, and then, what do you do with them,
I mean, there's certainly, the man in studying him seems to have no ego at all. He's one of the most humble individuals you could ever meet. He says, the best the best individuals for a position are those that don't ask for it.
Yep.
The idea that wait to be appointed on merit. And that's really what you see in Grant throughout his life, is that he, really has a low estimation of himself. He has confidence to some extent, but he has a low estimation. He's very humble. He's very approachable. Back when you can approach a president without being tackled by Secret Service or whatnot. So certainly you really do see that humble nature, and that played into it as well. He was able to keep focused even when they were throwing his name around in the third and fourth year of the war. As a potential replacement for candidate for president before the war even ended. He said, no, I'm here to serve and finish this war. I am not interested in the presidency. I mean, so that shows a lot. I mean, he could have easily just taken that route and been done with the terrible war and just, he knew Lincoln was better suited to that and for that position and wouldn't take it just out of ego or anything like that. So I think it shows a lot about
The character. Again, another thing off of the subject, George Steinbrenner, who was not a humble man by any means, but his father, they were very wealthy from shipping, and his father told him, if you ever do something, give money away in large sums to donate to whatever, don't do it under your name. You do it because you want to do it to help people out. And it seems like Grant was that way.
Yeah,
there's a
record that at some point his mother Hannah, who was a devout Methodist, very very humility was like one of her big things. She was very quiet and reserved, and that's where he got his character probably from. A lot of it. His father was a little bit more boastful, a little bit more outgoing and opinionated. But he took after his mother more, and his mother said basically with that kind of mentality, she said you should never really celebrate yourself for anything you've accomplished. You should celebrate the fact that God gave you the ability to do it. So it was kind of instilled him with that kind of that kind of idea that ego is just a bad thing, not necessarily no self-confidence, but just not having an unhealthy ego.
Right, and do it in the name of getting acclamation,
rather than
just doing it for the better good of humanity, And it seems that's how he was. He did things.
He did seem to desire to live an honest life. I mean, I don't want it to seem like you know, that's lopsided in terms of saying that he had no faults as right. a human, but certainly did seem to want to live his life to help serve others and be, you know, obviously productive for his nation.
Sure. Yeah.
He did quite a bit during his life.
One of the other things is, and I don't know if this is a fact or a myth, that he struggled with alcohol throughout his life. I mean,
I think it's just, I think the issue with that is that it receives a ton of attention. And most of the attention, you know, to Grant's relationship with alcohol comes more from a mythological kind of standpoint or an exaggerated standpoint of, you know, some of his opponents, especially in his political years, you know, utilize the old rumors of him being abusing alcohol in his earlier military career. The actual evidence, though, points to a person that really didn't have a substantial, constant, lifelong struggle. The evidence doesn't support that. It supports more a person that, you know, probably had a low tolerance for alcohol. That's very likely. Could not, you know, would exhibit the symptoms of inebriation earlier than most people, and so he stayed away from alcohol for that reason, and successfully, it seems. Occasionally, there would be periods where he would drink more than he could handle or could function, and I think that was probably an embarrassment to him. But that happened on a very very rare basis. Didn't affect his ability to you know, complete any major tasks that he did throughout his career. So I would say it's just vastly exaggerated and gets so much attention. I mean, there was certainly military officers that drank way more and even drank during conflict and battle. And that just wasn't Grant. So he receives the attention because it's just, those old army rumors and then the political machinations, they just don't, you know, they're hard to, it's really hard to take on reputation,
evidence,
even
right.
if the reputation is not fully deserved, it's hard to take on a reputation.
Well, once you say something about a person, it's very hard to, people get that in their heads and that's it.
And we kind of focus, especially even on history, you watch programs on the television stuff, a lot of it's, you know, scandal and crime and that's the intrigue. It's the intrigue and people want, oh, this was scandalous or this was, you know, and we kind of have that. We're drawn to that type of material and, you know, and so I think that's another part of it is that they say, you know, so people focused a lot on Grant's weaknesses, or supposed weaknesses, and sadly that started to overshadow, especially in the 20th century, the historiography of Grant, you know, really suffered from that being biased towards, you know, perceived weaknesses.
Sure.
As opposed to his strengths and his accomplishments.
Makes good fodder for back then newspapers and articles. I mean, to get people to read the newspapers about the president.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that,
I mean, he was revered, you know, after his death up until the early 20th century, but it started to take a real turn at that point, you know, once the Civil War veterans were dying off and then it really kind of took a, he took a pretty substantial, you know, dip in his, you know, reputation. But it's really in the last 20 years, it's nice to see that he's getting a more fair treatment, a more objective treatment. And really his presidential rankings especially have risen significantly. They take that every few years or whatnot. They have a presidential ranking from historians around the country. And he's risen up. I think the most recent one, he's 17. He rose up
terms.
From like down in the 30 or something.
Wow.
So he's risen up substantially.
Yeah.
And most of that comes from a very unknown period of American history, which is Reconstruction when he was president. And it was an incredibly difficult, you could almost say it was a second war that we fought at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Against racial and political violence.
Yeah. And that helped ratify the 15th Amendment, too, that Reconstruction. It was a real big problem back then to get that done.
Yeah, and Grant, again, he deserves a lot of credit for that. And he said the 15th Amendment makes 4 million people, the formerly enslaved individuals, makes them, you know, voters, gives them a say in government. And you know, and protects their rights. And he said that's the greatest act since the founding of this nation. I mean, that's a major, powerful statement to make.
Sure it is.
But really, you know, and people tend to forget this period because we, you know, we unfortunately there was this period where there was great gains being made in terms of equality and civil rights. It wasn't clean, but it was happening. And then it reverted after Grant's presidency because of the Compromise of 1877. It reverted to the Jim Crow era where again, there was suppression of voting and of African-American rights. So we forget that there was a period there, maybe, you know, 8 to 10 years around the end of the Civil War, where a generation of young African-Americans especially had the opportunity to get educated for the first time and, you know, have opportunities they never would have had a few years before that. And so that was a springboard for the later civil rights movements in the early throughout the 20th century. Sure. And so there was gains made, even though it did revert sadly back. Revert back.
I could never understand the term separate but equal. When it came to the blacks and the whites. I mean, yeah, they wanted to have them be equal, but they wanted them separate. You know, they had to go to their own restaurants, use their own restrooms, and that's not being equal, you know.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, during that period of Reconstruction, there was discussion at that early period, it wouldn't come up again for many, many years, but about segregation, as you're mentioning. And so there was actually, that's how much progress was being made that was even being brought up. The idea of ending or desegregation in that early period. So it was a lot happening and very quickly in that period. And obviously, culturally, ideologically, a large portion of the nation and the populace was not ready for that. And you know, there was a lot of prejudice that still existed from that was baked in from before.
Sure.
The Civil War period. So that's something where, you know, Grant himself admitted, you know, this is not going to happen overnight. You know, this acceptance of equality and things like this is going to be a generational thing. But he really wanted to set a precedent and set a standard for that to continue. And again, it's a little more complicated in his position on the Native Americans. But, you know, certainly he wanted to see, you know, he wanted to preserve their lives as much as he could. You know,
yeah.
Back then, that meant assimilation. That's
right.
What the view was, the perspective of how best to stop the bloodshed and have them become American citizens. So it was a difficult period that he was president, and I don't think he gets, you know, he's just starting to get the credit that really he deserves for navigating that as a, you know, non-politician, you know.
Exactly. Well, one of the other things that's amazing is that he prosecuted the Ku Klux Klan under his administration, and that was a big thing back then also, I think, which goes to show how much he wanted to have civil rights during his term.
And I think some people maybe don't understand. That's what about Reconstruction is very difficult to encapsulate, because it was spread, you know, throughout the South. There was all different conditions that existed after the Civil War in terms of racial and political violence. But the worst of it was the Klan. The Klan at the time was a domestic terrorist organization that was insurrectionary. They were again, you know, they were openly defying, you know, federal law, openly defying state laws, but they were shielded from those state and federal laws for a long time because until Grant, you know, moved forward and with Congress on the Klan Acts, the acts to bring federal forces and federal justice measures to the South, they couldn't prosecute because the Klan had infiltrated local law enforcement. They had state legislators. And all sorts of public officials, so the Klan could basically act with impunity, and they terrorized African Americans and Republican supporters.
Sure.
Republicans at the time, just to be clear, were the political parties. The radical Republicans that Grant was aligned with. They were, you know, interested in securing civil rights for African Americans.
Right.
The Democratic Party was openly you know, advocating for white supremacy.
Sure.
And openly. I'm not just saying that. That was their banner.
Oh, that was, yeah, that's so, on record. So, and that's why the Southern Democrats were so upset losing their plantations and their way of life from the Civil War loss, you know.
And it was a difficult period, but Grant was successful in disrupting, through those Klan acts, in disrupting the activity of the Klan. It was the largest and the first war on domestic terror we ever had. And so that's something that, again, doesn't receive, I think, the attention that it deserves. There's a lot of, you know, there's some parallels, you know, because we, you know, obviously still within our society still deal with, you know, extremism. We do.
Yeah. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And political and racial extremism, groups that have extreme ideologies. And so it's interesting, you know, that's the power of history, being able to look back and say, how was it dealt with then? How, you know, and you know, how could we learn from that earlier
sure.
period and address these issues that we have?
Well, you would hope from history that you would learn the bad things and not repeat them.
Right.
I mean, that's what you would hope. You learn from history, but sometimes it just doesn't happen. There was a... I see where he appointed African Americans and Jewish Americans to prominent offices, federal offices. And I read an article, I read it on the New York Times from back during Lincoln's period, that there was a very rich Jewish person who financed the Civil War for Lincoln. And Lincoln wanted to make him Treasury Secretary, and the man refused. But he would come to Saratoga every year for the summer, bring three carloads, railroad carloads, of his family, all his belongings, his servants, and he would stay at one of the big hotels in Saratoga. So one year he comes up, and his whoever, secretary or whoever, went in and came out and said, "We can't stay here. They won't let us in."
Mm-hmm.
Because he was Jewish.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't think that would happen up here, but it did. So I think by Grant doing this, appointing minorities to prominent positions, helped the cause also.
He was setting a precedent through all this, and that precedent certainly didn't necessarily last in that period, you know, post his presidential terms. But it did still set a precedent. There was still, you know, a positive gain from that. And he had, you know, made a grave error during the Civil War in terms of his relationship with the Jewish community, in putting through an order that, you know, again, he claimed himself that he had no prejudice against sect or race, that he wanted everyone judged by their merit. And that was a revolutionary statement, to say everybody should have a chance to prove themselves regardless of race or religion. And so, you know, that was a huge statement, you know, for that time period. And he really, I believe, tried to, you know, live that out and you know, see it realized.
Well, that's the Constitution.
Yeah, well, that too, yeah.
You know, that's
he didn't say that. He says we're finally realizing, starting to realize the true words of the Constitution. I mean, that's paraphrasing what he said
sure.
about the 15th Amendment, but. You know, certainly that was, he did take a very, what would be seen as a very progressive stance at that time during his presidential term. But he also advocated for African Americans to be able to join the Union forces as well. Not everybody was in favor of that. And he also, during the war itself, handled the refugee crisis of enslaved individuals fleeing to Union lines. He set up had someone set up schools and education for them. So he was very humane treatment
sure.
during the war, and he could have, you know, done some, he didn't have to do that necessarily. You
right.
know, he was trying to do it as humanely as possible, deal with that situation. And again, being an advocate at that stage for African-Americans and the, you know, and for their rights and
rights.
For their future, you know,
sure.
at that time. Yeah.
He seems to, I mean, I would classify him, and you know, if I'm wrong, as a constitutionalist, one who, I mean, our forefathers had great vision that we go by today, and I think he saw that and wanted to perpetuate a lot of that with all men are created equal, you know, and which kind of was disappeared back in the 1800s, but he was very smart and thought ahead about what things should be.
Yeah, I think he had a lot of foresight, and I think he looked to the future. He had a, you know, forward-thinking mentality. Again, just to be clear, he was subject to you can see a little evidence of some of the, you know, typical prejudice of the day in some of the things he said, but in the positions he took, but those were the, you know, a lot of it was commonly accepted. Some of it was called scientific racism, things like that. But none of that stopped him from, you know, the basic, you know, feeling of human dignity that he treated people with dignity. He wanted everyone to have opportunities, equal opportunities to prove right. themselves. That's the kind of thing that was very progressive about his stance.
Yeah.
I think on not just, you know, African Americans, other minorities as well.
Sure.
You know, at the very least, he was there to try to save their lives, human lives, which was what he was trying to do with the formerly enslaved and the Native Americans, especially in that era.
Now, is this true that he was supposed to be at the theater with Lincoln the night Lincoln was assassinated?
Grant was he was a very private person. He would get, you know, blush in public. He hated making public speeches. He was a very modest and private man. And so he would actually, and everywhere he went, he was, of course, adored and cheered, and that made it worse, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like he didn't appreciate that, but he didn't take adoration very well.
Sure.
And so he would kind of beg off of some of that stuff anyway. And so him and his wife were going to go, Julia, up to see the kids because he had been at war. They just signed the surrender at the end of the war, not too long before that. And so they begged off to go up to New Jersey where the kids were staying. And so that was the reason they gave. I mean, the other reason is he just didn't want to be in a public place, probably. And there's rumors about, you know, Julia not getting along with Mrs. Lincoln that well either, but he was a target of the assassination plot. That's been pretty much determined. And so somebody even tried to get on the train as he was heading north as well. That's another part of the story. And everybody forgets, I think it was Seward or whatever, who was in his bed, who got stabbed, you know, multiple times, but survived. You know, that was all part of a bigger plot to murder multiple head officials. You know, the idea of, and Grant said, the way Grant put it was, he said, we've put down the, I'll paraphrase here, but we put down the rebellion on the battlefield, and now it's coming. It's springing up in the gutters.
You know, I don't.
It's an insurgency. It was. You know, that was his goal, is to disrupt, you know, the war had failed for the rebellion, and this was just the next, you know, kind of a desperate attempt.
Nobody knows this. And I think it would make a good documentary on PBS about about things like that, how humble he was, and then how this happened after the war.
The History Channel put out a documentary a few years ago, and I was one of the talking heads for that. And they did a pretty good job, a pretty objective job of it, and gave a better, more well-rounded, a lot of it was military, but they did give a more well-rounded understanding of who Grant was in his life. And you could still, you know, find that on the internet, obviously, or on television. It's just called Grant, GRANT, through the History Channel. So if anybody's interested in kind of getting a bit more, PBS did one about 20 years ago that's still good, too. So there are some decent documentaries out there on Grant, but you can certainly always come to Grant Cottage as well. We'll give you some history as well.
Exactly. One of the other things that on that list, and then we can go into some things that are coming up at the cottage, that he wanted to pardon Davis for treason, or he tried to stop that process from going through, but I think eventually that lost, and I don't know if that's true what he wanted to do, or because I know they ended up being friends, I think, or they admired each other for their military prowess.
Yeah.
On the field. I don't know.
Well, you're thinking of Lee, but it's similar.
Oh, I'm sorry,
Lee. No, Davis was under the same kind of scrutiny, but the because all Confederate leaders were. Some people wanted them tried and hanged for treason.
Right.
And you know, so what occurred was after Lincoln's assassination, there was kind of a cry for vengeance or blood for that, you know, or for retribution against, you know. So at first Grant and some others had kind of a bit of an amnesty feeling, you know, let's try to move forward without having to have major criminal trials and hangings and all this. It's just going to inflame passions worse. And we're trying to kind of wind this war down, not have it spring up again in the gutters, like I was talking about. So Grant gets a letter from Robert E. Lee, the head of the general of the Army of Northern Virginia who he had taken a surrender from. And Lee asks him for him to vouch for him that he had given him a parole at the end of the war, that he wasn't going to have to be charged with treason. And so the reason he sent the letter is because he was getting charged for treason. It had reached that level where they were going to charge him in federal court and a few other Confederate leaders. Grant went toe-to-toe with Lincoln's vice president, who became president, Andrew Johnson. And Andrew Johnson was, going forward with this, with these trials. And Grant thought it would be the worst thing at a time when the nation needed to heal. So he ended up going toe-to-toe with Andrew Johnson and actually threatened his own resignation if Lee were tried. And so finally Johnson did back down. And so Grant actually, you know, what one person, another Confederate said was throw his shield in front of us, you know, to prevent this. A Confederate named John Mosby, Grant and him couldn't have been further apart as enemies during the war, but they actually ended up having a friendship, and Mosby became a Republican supporter after the war. So some of these former Confederates, James Longstreet, other major Confederates, actually ended up supporting Grant in his political career, and in, you know, progressing the country forward. So at a great risk to themselves within that system. Grant, you know, again, he was definitely focused on the healing of the nation. He didn't hate the Southern people. He didn't agree with their cause.
Right.
But he wanted to bring them back in as quickly and as peacefully as he could.
Into the fold of the nation again.
Yeah, bring the states back into the Union.
Well, you know, that happens in war. I mean, Revolutionary War, too. There were generals that admired each other on both sides, mm-hmm. because, and you know, they may not have loved each other, but they admired what they did. Let's talk a little bit, we have a few minutes left, about some of the things that are coming up. I know you have April 14th, you have a program.
Yes, we start off the year. The site isn't open yet, but on the 14th over at Saratoga Spa State Park, we're going to have our Friends annual meeting, which includes a presentation by the Saratoga County historian. So that's coming right up. We actually open for the season on Grant's birthday, as I mentioned earlier, Saturday, April 27th. We'll be open Friday through Sunday in May. Then after Memorial Day through October, we'll be 5 to 6 days a week, Wednesday through Sunday or Tuesday through Sunday. So plenty of opportunities to come. We do tours every half an hour. We have an absolutely beautiful overlook. We have presentations throughout the summer, and you can find more about that on our programming schedule on our website at grantcottage.org. So all different subjects, not just Grant, not just the Civil War. We cover other things as well. We have presentations on Tuskegee Airmen. We have authors that come, and we have even a Grant descendant that will be with us for in July to give a presentation as well. Ulysses Grant Dietz, so he's a great great grandson of the general himself.
All right, and one thing I'd like you to come back in the fall. One thing I want to get into is Burke Funeral Home, which is still alive and
oh yes,
today.
We have a presentation on that this summer as well. And I'll just make a quick note, if I can, that we are the Friends of Grant Cottage. So it's a state historic site on the mountain there. We got a nice visitor center, and we do the tours of the house, and we do tours of the grounds as well. But we are a nonprofit, so we certainly we're supported, and we appreciate the support through membership donations. And there are opportunities to volunteer. If you ever thought of becoming a volunteer tour guide, we have positions open, and you can apply online
That's
well.
Great.
So,
Ben, I'm glad you were with us today. Ben Kemp, who's the operations manager for the U.S. Grant Cottage State Historic Site. So I appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much. And everybody come visit us this summer.
You got it. And I'll be there also.